accession number 10723, real one.
Captain Lamb, real one. Whereabouts were you born, Captain?
In London.
And which year was that?
1906.
What did your father do for a living?
He was in the Indian Civil Service.
And what was your education?
A private preparatory school in Eastbourne, where I went at the age of 7, followed by Naval College at Osborne, and after that the Naval College at Dartmouth.
What was it like at Osborne in those days?
The discipline was strict, as I expected. The buildings were criticised because theoretically they were temporary buildings built before World War I to accommodate the college, but the main buildings were the stables of Osborne House, and this was thought to create possibilities of illness, making it an unsuitable site for boys of the tender age of 13. But certainly I noticed nothing like that at all.
Were the boys healthy when you were there?
Oh, yes.
Which years were you at Osborne?
I was there for 2 terms, starting in September 1920.
Were there any famous people there with you?
None that I remember in particular detail.
No members of royal families?
No. One or two became reasonably good at games and played for the Navy and that sort of thing, but not of national importance.
Do any of the teachers stick out in your mind?
At Dartmouth, yes, there was a physics teacher who embarrassed me when I first went to class with him, because he greeted me with saying, with the comment, "The last Lamb that I had was a clever boy," which I found a little embarrassing as an introduction.
Were you very good at your studies at Dartmouth?
Pretty good. I passed out 2nd in the term, in the passing out examination. But I was competitive, and I disliked being seen off by anyone.
What were your favourite subjects at Dartmouth?
I find that difficult to answer at this range. Music was one of my things, but I never became a player. I was only a listener or a singer, but I didn't learn any musical instrument or anything like that.
Do you remember the year that you left Dartmouth?
Oh yes, April 1924.
What did you think of the training at Dartmouth? Do you think that it prepared you adequately for what was to come?
At the time, of course, I accepted it because there was nothing more to do and I wanted to join the Navy. Looking back on it, I think the system of organisation at Dartmouth, whereby all the people who joined the college at a particular time remained a group as a term, and so that there was no interchange, or very little interchange of experience between people of different ages in the college, and I think a house system might really have been a better basic organisation.
Now, I think you must have been in the Navy when the notorious Invergordon mutiny occurred. I think it was 1931.
Yes.
You weren't at Invergordon yourself then?
I was not. I was... just about to start a gunnery specialist course and was at the Royal Naval College Greenwich at that time, and so I was not in contact with any actual load ratings at that time at all.
What was your own reaction when you heard about the mutiny?
Shock and almost incredulity. I was very struck, though, the commandant of the college at that time, whose name I can't recollect, I think it was Ginger Boyle, Ginger because of his red hair, and his attitude was that his generation had failed the Navy in allowing a situation to arise in which there should be a mutiny of any kind at all. And it showed me, impressed me, that the unusual sort of situation that the service had got into, that one could see a senior officer, a respected officer, admitting that a particular group had been carried out their job not as well as they should have done.
What was your own attitude towards the mutineers? Did you have any sympathy for them, or did you feel that it was... did you feel that the government had acted correctly?
I think that it was basically a lack of understanding of what the reactions would be and the imposition of... of wage cuts, salary cuts, which a lack of understanding of the effect that that would have on the sailors or who are on low salaries anyway. If there had been better communication, I don't think the mutiny would have arisen at all.
Did you detect any signs of trouble in the south of England, where you were?
No, the people who took part in the mutiny at Invergordon came from all over the country. There were West Country ships there and Chatham Bay ships there, so that it was not the domicile and the hope and the place of back upbringing of the sailors didn't matter. They were all sailors, and they came from all over the country, and they were equally involved.
But there didn't seem to be any trouble in, say, Portsmouth or Chatham or Devonport.
No, because I think they were, what shall I say, In Invergordon, there was a concentration of people, numerically and geographically. I think that in their home ports, people were less immediately affected or not infected by others.
Can we go on to the outbreak of war? And can you tell me what you were doing when Chamberlain made his famous announcement that we were at war with Germany, and how you reacted?
I was on the staff of the Portsmouth Gunnery School in 1939, and I think we had been aware that war was likely to break out for quite a long time. And so the development of the situation to actual declaration of war was no surprise at all. My job at the gunnery school at that time was also in charge of the anti-aircraft firing range, which was based at Eastney and is now called the Fraser Battery, after Lord Fraser of good renown. It was an interesting job because, on the whole, I think insufficient attention had been given in the preparation for war to the training of people to use close-range anti-aircraft weapons. The big guns were the important ones, and the small ones mattered less. And so there was a good deal of feeling of nakedness, shall I say, in our close-range anti-aircraft gunnery abilities. And so I felt I was in a job that really had something to do.
What kind of anti-aircraft guns were being used at that stage in the war on ships?
The close-range gun, the main gun, was known as the Chicago Grand Piano. It was an 8-barrel, 2-pounder gun. And the idea was to fill the air with explosive little shells and hope that some of them might possibly find the aircraft target in its way.
Did that work?
It was a difficult gun to operate because it was a big piece of machinery, and it required to have a separate layer and trainer. And to get these two people to work in sympathy with each other was quite a problem, because one was responsible for moving the gun in one direction and the other for moving the other. And unless they saw the situation in their sights exactly the same, they would be chasing each other around, trying to get the gun pointing in the right direction.
So one was moving it horizontally and
the
one
other
vertically.
Vertically.
Which direction did the layer move it?
Vertically. And the trainer moved it laterally.
So they could be working against each other?
They could work. The only way to overcome this was for them to practice together. It required people. And so it was a difficult problem. The difficulty was got over to some extent by the introduction of a joystick control, where you had one man control who could move a joystick laterally or vertically. And with power follow-up mechanisms, he could control the gun himself. However, it was a job with a certain amount of scope for individual ideas and introduction of new methods of training and training devices.
And who was actually doing the training of the gunners, not you yourself?
No, we had petty officers and leading seamen who had been trained themselves, and they were then used for the actual instruction and the supervision of the layers and trainers. My function was organization, safety, and the handling of other people who wished to see what was required in an AA range. So we had visitors from the army as well as from other naval establishments.
Did you at that time know if there were any new techniques or equipment on the way to replace what you already had?
Oh yes, and the Oerlikon gun was imported from Sweden, no, from Switzerland. Um, just at the beginning of the war, and that was a radical improvement because the gun was much lighter, it could be manipulated and handled entirely by one man, and he could use the gun as a sort of an extension of his own body and aim it more naturally.
With air guns on ships, was the object mainly to drive the planes away or actually to shoot them down?
The first intention really is to be a deterrent. The number of aircraft shot down by guns during the war is, I think, minimal. I think that the effectiveness of anti-aircraft gunfire at that time was almost entirely as a deterrent rather than as a killer.
What are your next memories?
I was appointed away from the AA range in August 1940, and was glad to be sent to the Mediterranean, where Italy had joined the war and things seemed to be becoming more active than they had been. And the Mediterranean Command felt they had a need for someone experienced in anti-aircraft gunnery to improve the anti-aircraft performance of the Mediterranean fleet. And so in August, September 1940, I was appointed as Fleet Anti-Aircraft Officer in the Mediterranean Fleet. I took passage to my new appointment in HMS Valiant, which was going out to join the fleet, and was one of the first ships to have been fitted with radar, or RDF as it was called in those days. And so I had the opportunity to learn about radar, which was had been a closely guarded secret up to that time. And
what were the problems of working with radar in those days?
The problems of working with radar was the actual radars themselves were effective, but the ships hadn't had experience of how to integrate the information that the radar gave them into the general control systems of the ship.
Can you describe your responsibilities that you took up in the Mediterranean once you got there?
Yes. I found myself as in the position of an assistant to the fleet gunnery officer, and through him reported to the Chief of Staff, Admiral Willis, and to the Commander-in-Chief, Admiral Cunningham. One of the first things I did was to establish and create an anti-aircraft firing range at Alexandria for the ships of the fleet. But I found myself also involved as the Commander-in-Chief's representative on an inter-service committee which was concerned with the anti-aircraft defences of Alexandria, the fleet base. And there was a difference of outlook between the RAF and its functions for the defence of Alexandria and the fleet. The RAF had only one night fighter that they could operate at that time of Alexandria, and even if that was successful in shooting down one or more Italian aircraft, the Navy was much more concerned about what happened to the ones who weren't shot down. And the question is whether the guns of the fleet should be silent to enable the fighters to drive off the attack, or whether the fleet should look after its own interests for itself. The advent of radar into the fleet did enable us to use the deterrent effect of gunfire by giving a little bit more accuracy to the defense by blind barrage, which I instituted. That meant that one would have every ship in harbor would have a responsible for firing their guns in a particular direction and at a particular angle, and the ship with radar would give them the moment when they should start their barrage by his knowledge of how far the target aircraft was at that particular moment.
So the idea of the blind barrage was just to fill the air with a mass of gunfire?
A mass of gunfire which would deter the Italians from pressing home their attack. Effective, but most inefficient. If you work out number of aircraft shot down against the ammunition expended. But survival was the important thing.
And did the Italians press home their attacks?
The number of bombs dropped in Alexandria Harbour did their attacks was very few. Very few. And this is not criticizing the bravery of the Italian airmen. It was a formidable sight, sufficient to deter them.
Could you tell me about the activities of the British Mediterranean Fleet at that time?
Well, the arrival of the Valiant in the Mediterranean and of the Illustrious as an aircraft carrier with her improved the situation in the Mediterranean quite radically. The big task at that time was the sustainment of Malta as a base for the operations of craft to cut the Italian supply lines from Italy to Benghazi. And there was a routine of almost once a month, there would be a convoy run from Alexandria or from Gibraltar to keep Malta supplied. The Illustrious was the first ship in the Mediterranean, first carrier in the Mediterranean to have modern aircraft and radar control for them, and by the end of 1940 it was almost the expected thing for convoys to run without any interruption whatsoever. I remember one particular incident on in December 1940, when the Queen Elizabeth, Warspite, the fleet flagship, with Admiral Cunningham on board, actually entered Valletta Harbour at the time of the successful arrival of that particular convoy. And all the citizens of Malta mustered on the ramparts and, instead of cheering, just clapped their hands, which was somehow very much more telling, had very much more telling effect, shall I say, than wavings of arms and shouting.
You mean clapped their hands in unison?
In.
Or?
Yes.
In rhythmically? Did you witness that?
Oh yes, I was there on the bridge, which was my station there. The other actions, of course, about that time was the air attack by the Mediterranean fleet on the Italians in Taranto.
Did you have anything to do with that action?
No, my function was anti-aircraft, not not the operation of aircraft. I was merely there in case there was an Italian response, but the fleet returned from that operation without any sustaining any damage whatsoever.
Where were you? Which ship were you on?
I was on the on board the flagship HMS Warspite.
What kind of a ship was Warspite to serve on and to live on?
She was built at the end of World War One, so she was fairly long in the tooth. She needed modernization, and in point of fact did go to the States for a modernization refit during the course of that year. I suppose from my point of view an unsatisfactory flagship, because I was too junior to qualify for a splendid cabin, and in point of fact I had to live on board another ship and embark in Warspite with a suitcase when the fleet put to sea for operations, which was unsatisfactory in many ways, but it was that's how things were.
So where did you sleep on board the Warspite?
Oh, I had a little nook in a corner where I lived, had a suitcase, and I used someone else's cabin for washing and so on.
Did you sling a hammock?
Well, I could have slung a hammock, but I preferred to sleep on the deck. I laid my hammock out on the deck.
You've mentioned Cunningham once or twice. Did you actually come into close quarters with the Admiral?
Oh, yes. My detailed function during when the fleet was under air attack was to watch the high-level bombers coming over and to tell the Admiral when the bombs were falling down so that he didn't have to lie down on the deck to take shelter until the last possible moment.